I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episode 7 of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the double homicide in 2002. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. Now, if you haven't listened to the episode we're going to be talking about, pause this podcast, go back and listen, and then come back to this conversation. We will still be here. With us today is Susan Simpson, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, also a lawyer and super investigator. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rebecca.
Also with us is Jacinda Davis. She's an executive producer at Red Marble Media. That's the company behind Killer in Question, which covered the Titus case. And she's also the best to Susan's Nancy Drew, by the way, or maybe the George. I'm not sure. Hey, Jacinda, how are you?
Hi, Rebecca. I'm fine. Thanks.
Also with us is Colin Miller, the Associate Dean and Professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and my favorite legal Siri. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
Good. Now, I alluded to it in the intro, but I want to start with this whole theme about trespassing being something of grave concern, apparently, in the community where these crimes happened. Susan, why does trespassing cause such strong emotions? And you guys experienced that yourself, as we heard on the podcast.
So I'm not entirely sure I get it. The part I do get is the hunters part. Like, that would set my hackles up. And like the people who are uncomfortable with hunters being on their land, 1,000% I get. I don't think I quite necessarily feel the same visceral reaction to like the non-gun-toting trespassers that some people feel.
Yeah. I mean, I live in a pretty rural place, and I have to tell you, I'm not like a territorial person, but when we see, you know, headlights kind of coming up our little road or whatever, I do just think, like, what are they doing here? Like, I think it. I don't, like, go outside and ask them questions.
And grill them.
But I do think, like, who is that? What are they doing? Who are they visiting? I can't help it. That's something that just changes in your brain, I think, when you live in the middle of nowhere. Jacinda, you've talked to Titus. Do you get the sense of territoriality from him in the conversations he has with you now?
You know, I don't think he would call it that, but yes, I think he was aware of who was coming on and off of his property. You know, and he had at the time two small children, and the property did abut the Fulton game area. So he didn't want just people with their guns walking around and shooting on his property. That makes sense to me.
I will say, though, I have never heard Titus... I mean, again, he's talking to you years later. He knows that this is for a show. So I'm not sure for Titus that would matter. But he, you know, theoretically could be guarding his language. But I've never heard Titus talk in the same way that Jacinda, we've heard people talk over there when they have that real deep, like, whatever it is. Like, the intense, not just, like, concern or, like, here's something. It's, like, an actual, like, I don't know, like, their integrity or moral honor has been violated by a trespasser walking on it.
Yeah.
I think it wasn't even just his property. I think he's like what you might call a nosy neighbor. He, you know,
that's what it is.
Yeah, he liked knowing what was going on everybody's property.
I guess that's what it is for me too. It's like he definitely has a busybodiness about him, but it's not. It doesn't. I don't think it's territorial. The instinct that's driving him is not territorial. It's snoopy, or not even snoopy. Yeah. It's like keeping an eye on things.
Yeah, that's small town stuff. I'm not kidding. It's so common. It's certainly not, to me, something that would motivate someone to, you know, disappear from their day in an unexplained way, go murder somebody and then sneak back, you know. But that what you're describing, and even what I heard in the podcast where that guy approached your car, like, I can imagine that happening in my neighborhood. I mean, it wouldn't be me, but I could imagine someone being like, hey, can I help you, if they saw, you know, somebody just sitting around. I don't know. It doesn't seem like a motive for murder for me.
Well, even I think it was like two addendum shows ago, Susan and I were pulled over in like a corn field, and we both like looked at each other like, you know, I guarantee 15 minutes someone will be knocking on our window. Well, and it happened.
But we guessed three people. No, we said like over under where like three people will stop and talk to us. Only one did. So we overestimated their territorialness there.
This is why Colin's not on the road with you. He cannot deal with this, right, Colin? Colin, it's something that I want to ask you about. We heard in the episode a lot about these Rule 404B situations around witnesses. Can you just explain what 404B is, what the purpose of it is?
Yeah, so there's Rule 404A and 404B. And 404A says we generally can't admit what's known as propensity character evidence. Once a robber, always a robber. Once an arsonist, always an arsonist. This person has a propensity to engage in violent acts and therefore likely acted in conformity with that propensity at the time of the crime charged. 404B then says if you're not engaging in this propensity conformity analysis, but you're proving something like knowledge of how to, say, crack a safe, or you're proving motive, there was previous acrimony between this defendant and this victim. So you're not saying this person is generally violent. You're saying they had a specific motive to be violent in this case, or their past crime of safe cracking proves they know how to crack a safe. That would be an exception that would allow character evidence in limited circumstances.
Where is this rule like enacted? Is it everywhere or is it just certain states?
Everywhere. I think
okay.
44 states have some version of the Federal Rules of Evidence, which have 404A and 404B. Even the six states that don't, their sort of common law precedent would recognize this dichotomy.
Yeah, and Michigan has a 404A and B on the books.
Yes.
Very similar, if not identical, to the federal one.
Huh. So why is propensity evidence not allowed? Propensity character evidence?
This goes back historically to England and the Star Chamber that was used by the Stuarts and the Tudors, and they used to have their enemies hauled in before this secretive Star Chamber and use all sorts of character evidence to convict them. Basically, three rationales for not allowing propensity character evidence in. One, people can change. Just because you were violent 10 years ago doesn't mean you're violent today. Two, it's sort of the jury might convict because this is a bad guy as opposed to he committed this particular crime. So if we hear this person has a history of violent acts and the evidence of this particular violent crime is weak, they might overestimate that evidence of the prior behavior. And then third, it's just a matter of fairness. The person is charged with this particular crime, and if you allow in propensity character evidence, you're forcing them to defend against all sorts of other behavior you're bringing in that they're not currently charged with. And of course, we see that in the Titus case with these other encounters coming in where he's forced to defend not only this current case, the murder of the two victims, but also these other encounters with hunters.
Implying he did defend against them as if that happened, but you know.
Correct.
I feel like this rule gets broken all the time. I really do. I mean,
yes.
Doesn't it seem?
Yes.
I mean, how many times on this show have we heard about trials? I mean, even in the Adnan Syed case, to some extent, where it's like, well, he is this. He is jealous. He is this. He is that. So therefore, so this rule gets broken a lot, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately, courts have, there's this common phrase, they say Rule 404B is a rule of inclusion, not a rule of exclusion. And it's really almost come full circle since the Star Chamber, where it used to be we had this strong prohibition on the use of character evidence. And now through this sort of backdoor of 404B, as you noted, Rebecca, and we've seen it in a lot of these cases, a court typically will find a 404B rationale, even whereas in this case, it shouldn't apply and this evidence shouldn't come in because really, obviously, we all know the prosecution here is not using this to prove this distinctive modus operandi. They're just using it to show, look, this guy gets in fights and has acrimony with hunters on his property. And so he likely did the same thing here, which is, of course, improper, but we couch it in motive or modus operandi.
The reason the prosecutor wants it in there is to show this person is the kind of person who would have done this, which is why it's such a problematic type of evidence in the first place, because I think statistically, jurors aren't able to process what that would mean. Let's say someone was the kind of person to do a certain kind of crime, whatever that means. The next logical jump for a lot of juries is, okay, that means they probably did this. But you could have like 100 people in town who are the kind of person likely to do that. And by itself, it's just not meaningful evidence to point to who actually did do it.
This sounds like a prosecution rule, right? Is there a defense version of this? Because this happens all the time, too, to witnesses for the defense, you know, witnesses who get impeached or, you know, people, even victims sometimes on the stand. It's sort of like, are you the kind of person who goes to bars and flirts with men or whatever? I think that's immediately what I'm thinking about. So is this just something that the prosecution is supposed to abide by, but not the defense?
So there's two defense friendly character evidence rules. So 404A2 is called the mercy rule, and it says if you're charged with a crime, it's a Pandora's box. If you don't want to introduce propensity character evidence, great, it's not going to come in. If you want, though, and this is typically in self-defense cases, you can attack the character of the victim and say they're a violent person, and that then opens the door for character evidence coming in. And then Rebecca, under 404B, there is what we call reverse 404B evidence, where Titus, for instance, could come in and say, this is the modus operandi, not of me, but of a serial killer who tends to kill hunters. And this is his MO. That proves someone else committed this crime and not me. And so you can use reverse 404B to claim this is someone else's signature crime, not my signature crime.
Okay. All right. I think I get it, even though it seems wacky and like a rule that nobody follows, but that's fine. So what was the 404B evidence in this case, Susan?
Well, the purpose of the 404B evidence was it's frustrating to read the hearing from when the judge evaluated all this, because they just basically the prosecution just invokes a bunch of typical 404B buzzwords. Like, oh, it proves the identity of Titus. It proves, like, his motive. It proves, like, why he'd be in the woods looking for trespassers. It's modus operandi, which, I mean, modus operandi is evidence, like Colin said, like, you have someone's, like, distinctive handiwork. It's, like, you know, the kind of thing only one kind of killer would do, or the kind of robbery only the guys at Home Alone would do. So you can use that to say, like, okay, well, here's, like, a reasonable reason to assume that the one person did all these crimes. Here, I mean, the judge allowed it, but to me, it's baffling to think that even if there were encounters between a landowner and a hunter in the woods, that that's distinctive handiwork of any sort whatsoever. But the evidence that was admitted under this rule was testimony about four different encounters that Titus supposedly had or did have in the woods. And we had Richard Adams, the Whitby encounter, Bonnie Huffman, and Dale Beatty. I was thinking while I was writing this episode, too, that, like, Titus was there for 12 years. If he was really the kind of obsessive territorial guy that they're saying he is, this is really all the evidence you'd have from that?
Yeah.
But there's just these four. And to me, they're extremely weak in terms of evidence.
Yeah. I mean, one of these witnesses is somebody who, like, uses an alias and, like, apparently has his own, like, weird backstory.
Right? I feel like there's a story there that I haven't found yet. Like, something's going on with that guy. That's Richard Adams, who
goes by Dick Lehue.
Dick Lehue. Yeah. And, you know, I still don't know what the hell is going on there. Apparently neither did the police or the prosecutor, since they all call him Richard Adams. And since he died, we'll probably never know. But this guy pops up really early on. He calls in and he has a report that, at least from Orsima's report, seems legit. He was out hunting in the game area, not too far from where the victims were found. He was beyond them, farther away from Titus's property still, but same-ish area. And he says someone came up, talked to him, said, hey, that's not a good idea to be hunting here. And he also says goes and finds two more people in the game area and talks to them. And Richard Adams then sees them turn around and leave too. Of course, by the time we get to trial, we've got this story about how he was screaming and hollering and pointed his gun at me and was definitely Titus, even though before he had no clue. Well, before he said it wasn't Titus at all. So to me, it's I really want to know, one, why the prosecutor was like, let's try and get this in anyway. And two, why the defense just so dropped the ball here.
Yeah. I want to know that, too. Colin, what do you think about this shifting story? This isn't uncommon, right, over this long period of time, and it's also not great.
No, I mean, this, you know, obviously, as is laid out in the episode, is a case where most of this character evidence doesn't exist initially. And, of course, this is the cold case team that's investigating years later. And then you have these witnesses come out of the woodwork, including one who is, you know, seeking release from jail to get his father to testify. And so Yeah, unfortunately, our perceptions can be skewed by what we see, and it seems clearly in this case that people heard that Titus had been arrested, and they heard the state's narrative, and probably not intentionally, maybe in the case of the son who's in the jail, but they slanted their testimony against Titus when, as sort of laid out in the episode, his behavior doesn't seem inconsistent with other people who lived in the same area.
I will say Richard Adams seems more extreme to me than most. I can't think of another case where you'd had a witness positively disidentify or whatever, say it's definitely not the defendant.
Not him.
And then come on the stand later and say, oh, yep, totally him. And not even get questioned about it. That's a new one for me.
Right. So Jacinda, I just keep thinking about this over and over again. In this case, and I think more so than in other cases we've talked about on this podcast, that some people, when something like this happens and it's, you know, somebody that they're tangentially connected to, some people are just like, they'll do anything to not be involved, right? They'll just like slam the doors on the cops. They'll be like, I don't want to get involved. They just want no like exposure to it, nothing to do with it. Other people seem to really like jumping in to these stories and like becoming a character in the story, becoming a witness, you know, and maybe it's not on purpose. I don't really know, but it just does seem like there are kind of two kinds of people when you have cases like this. What do you think about that, Jacinda? I know you've interviewed a lot of witnesses in your time as a true crime producer.
Yeah, I think you're right. There are two categories of people like you described, and a lot of people don't want anything to do with it. And they have to be subpoenaed to talk about it. And then others like to insert themselves into the story. And, you know, Bonnie comes to mind from Titus. I feel like she's somebody who kind of inserted herself into the story. But I don't think that means necessarily people are lying. I think, like Colin was saying, you know, you come to believe things you hear, your memory changes or whatever. But I don't know what it is about people, you know, the difference between those kinds of people, the people who want to be a big part of it and the ones who don't want anything to do with it. And and where that in-between line is.
Yeah. So can you just remind everybody what the Bonnie Huffman incident was that she describes as having happened?
Sure. So Bonnie says she was hunting on her parents' property in a tree, like her favorite hunting tree. And it borders Jeff's property line. And Jeff was new. This happened, I think, soon after they had moved into the farm. And she says he approached her and, you know, pointed a pistol at her, asked her who she was, and told her that she was on his property. Now, Jeff does remember this happening. He does remember everything except pointing the gun at her. He's right. Like, yeah, I know exactly what tree she's talking about. And yeah, I did go over and said, who are you? Because I didn't know who she was. And then she told me she was, you know, the daughter. And I said, okay, you know, and that was it. So it's one of those things. You have one incident, both people remember it, but they have completely different stories about what actually went down.
Again, Colin, not uncommon, right? I mean, there's sort of the lens of being helpful, talking to the cops, hearing the questions the prosecutor asks. And it is kind of easy to see how a witness's brain could go there, change the story to better fit the narrative, right?
Yeah, but in this case, I mean, for that portion of it, absolutely. When you start getting into her story about when she saw Jeff Titus on the day of the double homicide, and that time changes three times, and it goes from, you know, a nighttime encounter to a time that fits perfectly with the state's timeline. Maybe that's a good faith change, but I feel like the state kind of leaned on her there, and of course, I can't prove that, but it seems like something beyond just an honest mistake is going on with that change in the time.
We need to 404B her on it because she's changed a lot of things over and over again. So it's like, how do you, Jay Wilds question. How do you believe anything?
Here's what I do believe, though. I do believe that Bonnie had an incident with Titus that she was upset about. I couldn't say it's confirmed, but like, I feel like that part's real. There was an incident. It did upset her. At trial, she says he pointed a gun at her, but that's the part of the story I'm not buying for various reasons. But I also think Jeff, maybe his memory is not always, I feel like he does not always quite understand the other point of view. Let's put it that way. He has this other story about
an encounter. Are you saying he has tunnel vision?
I'm saying that he often doesn't put himself in other shoes very well.
I'm going to say he lacks emotional intelligence. That's the way that I would describe it.
That's a good one. Because he has a story about like another set of people who are not trespassing on his property, but his neighbor's land that he often watched over. So if he saw someone in the Holiday Land, which is the one south of him that Alan Stanton watched over, he'd often go check it out too, just say, hey, what's up? And at one time, there were some trespassers there, and it was a father and son hunting, and the son had a shotgun pointed at his toe, or like holding it down so it angled his foot. And Titus, I am sure, was not like, excuse me, sir, can I politely point out a danger and help you out? I'm sure he was like, this is not proper procedure. You should cease and desist immediately. Which was upsetting to the dad, which isn't surprising. I think I can easily see that happening with Bonnie and him like being like, what are you doing hunting with a gun in September in a tree? And from her point of view, it'd be like, wait, I'm on my parents' land. I'm out of sight of any game land over here on the side of the property. And you're questioning my law abiding on my own land.
Yeah. But that does seem like something he would do, in your opinion.
Yeah. Jacinda, what do you think?
I agree. Yeah. It seems like something he would do. I don't think he would point the gun at her.
We're 404 being him right now, by the way. It's all I can think about.
I also think that, you know, Titus, his family, they were new to the neighborhood. They had just bought the property in like July, moved in. And everyone loved the previous owners. And even now when you go to talk about it, no one calls it the Titus farm. They still call it by the previous, you know, they're like the Stryker farm. So I also think there was like, he's the new neighbor in town, and the previous owners would let people hunt on the property. And, you know, so it was also sort of, he needed to establish his rules and who he was. And I have a feeling people were getting used to him still. So some of this behavior rubbed them the wrong way.
It's worth pointing out that the Strikers are probably one of, if not the most prominent families in Kalamazoo. So having Homer Stryker there was kind of like having your own celebrity.
Right
at, you know, your next door neighbor. So having like the Stryker there is kind of a point of pride. And I definitely get the sense the Burnworths kind of felt that way. And they talk about how like they got to, you know, they would be the ones to scare trespassers off of his land when he was too old to get back there and watch. So having like Homer Stryker replaced with Jeff Titus, you know, there
felt
goes
like
the
a downgrade. Is that what you're saying?
There goes the neighborhood. Yeah.
I'm curious about this whole property line conversation. You know, again, I don't want to like always say there are two kinds of people, but it does seem like there are people who don't really care where their property lines are. And there are people who care a lot where their property lines are and know them well. Which category do you think Jeff Titus falls into, Susan?
Knows them well.
Okay.
He
perambulates.
He has like probably like names for each tree out there. Like, each, like I was talking to him, I think the first time I ever talked to him, I've been visiting the game area and I had some like technical questions and kind of the layout there. And even 20 years on, he can like, he's like, oh yeah, it's about 5, maybe 7 yards past that. Take like a 90 degree turn to the right and then walk there. And that's where the tree will be. And like, he still knows his property that well. So the idea of him like confusing his property lines, I don't think that's likely.
Do you guys have perambulating where you live, or is that just a New England thing where people walk? Perambulating is, by the way, when you go out and you walk your own property boundaries.
Didn't even know the word.
It's a thing here, and it's a thing between the states of New Hampshire and Vermont. The border gets perambulated every so often. I don't really understand it, but apparently it's an activity that people like to engage in.
I just want to point out that my favorite part of all of the Bonnie Hoffman story is like the mom statement that I found. It wasn't in the main file. I found it at the Kalamazoo Sheriff's Office from the mother's May 2000 interview, where there's this random aside about how Titus would come in and rummage through her cupboards for food.
Like, oh, yeah. What? Like a grown-up raccoon? Like, is that like, what you described him?
There's nothing else anywhere that even remotely sounds like that. That's like the most out of the blue thing I've seen in this case ever. Like, what?
It's such a weird detail, though. You kind of have to think it's true.
No, it's not that. Like, it's so weird. It's definitely not true. Like, Titus wouldn't do that. And also, if he had, she'd be talking about it all the time.
He wasn't friends with people like that. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's very obvious. Right. I mean, that's something that, you know, I have friends who'd be comfortable walking into my house and opening my fridge. But like, Titus doesn't seem like he has relationships like that.
I just cannot imagine him doing that for anyone, let alone the Burnworths. Which makes me wonder, why was she like, in the interview context, it kind of sounds like they're asking her, did you have problems with him? And that's her response. I'm like, where is this coming from? Like, what motivated her to say that? Like, it's just such a strange...
It also sounds like a description of a good relationship, not a bad one.
Yes, yes. A strange one, but more a good one than bad. So definitely not the kind of guy that you, like the first month on the land, he points a gun at your daughter.
Right. And then you let him in and rummage through your cabinets for cookies or whatever.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to the Whitbys. Susan, can you remind us who the Whitbys are?
So the Whitbys are a family from Comstock, where Doug Estes was from. And every year they'd go and camp down in the parking area east of Bear Creek off of X Avenue. And they'd stay there for a couple weeks, like hunt in the game area. And it was like their annual family tradition. And we actually know that they had been there that year, 1990, when this all happened, because when Mark Perry was walking into the game area that day with Doug and Bobby, he looks at the sign-in sheet and says, oh, Ted Whitby was here. But he's gone at that point. They'd already left for some reason. And even after the murders, apparently the Whitby family is not at all deterred. Actually, I was talking to Ted Whitby, and he was telling me, he was like, they set up a truck with like a secret camera on it, try and film people coming in under the belief that the killer might return. And so we were out there hunting for them to see if we could draw someone over. I'm like, wait, y'all were bait? And he was like, yeah, it was fine.
Weird.
And he was
when
cool
did they
with
do
it.
That?
The year after, 1991, the same year this incident happens. Yeah. So he says that they were there, like, I mean, a little bit kind of wary, but they were willing to be the bait if it would help possibly solve Doug's murder. But the same year, also 91, is when this event happens Well, what we know for a fact is that Chris Whitby, the 17-year-old stepson of one and the nephew of the other two, was in Titus's cornfield. Titus catches him there and gets him out of the cornfield back onto the game area one way or another. And this incident is never reported to anyone until after Titus's arrest. This is something that was never, like almost like everything but Richard Adams, none of these events came to light until after Titus was arrested, which makes you think that like none of them thought it was evidence of murder until they, you know, saw his mugshot on TV.
Yeah.
So anyway, at trial, they have Ted Whitby, who's older, the uncle of Chris Whitby, and Chris Whitby testify at about this whole thing. And the part of their story that's the same is they both say that Titus had Chris Whitby at gunpoint with a shotgun. But they have very different, like, the details don't match up at all. Like, they're different stories, really. One's about Ted's story is like how, we went back for lunch and Chris was gone. So we searched for him and found him, like, being held at gunpoint. Chris's, I think, is closer to the truth. It's closer to Andrew Holt's and to Titus's story. But again, has Andrew Holt and his stepdad, Clayton, coming out, finding Titus, holding him at gunpoint and going, whoa, what are you doing? How dare you? Stop that. And this event definitely happened, which probably hurt Titus at trial because like there's no dispute it occurred, and in fact Julie, his wife, testifies about it and says yes, that happened, but there's no one at gunpoint.
So what's up for dispute is how Titus may or may not have been threatening him.
How did Titus react to this? And this party had four people in it. Well, I'm actually not even convinced Ted Whitby was there, because Ted Whitby's story is strange and no one else really talks about him being involved. But we know Andrew Holt was there, and the police talked to him and found out, like, Jacinda, like, when we talked to him, his first thing he said is, like, yeah, I talked to the police, and they're like, your story is really benign, ain't it? I'm like,
yeah, exactly. He was like, they said it wasn't good enough for him, basically.
And the defense knew about this for sure. Like, there's no question they knew that Andrew Holt's story would have been contradicting the other Whitbys. And they don't call him. And Titus doesn't know about it till he's in jail and is part of a prison ministry after his conviction. Andrew Holt comes through with his group, and at some point he's like, hey Titus, I just want you to know, I remember that day, you were fine, you weren't inappropriate, you acted the way a landowner would reasonably act when they found someone hunting on their land. And the jury never gets to hear that, because I feel very confident Andrew Holt would have testified straight had he been called.
Jacinda, do you agree?
I agree 100%. And it's one of those things, like, I don't understand, like, why didn't Jeff's lawyer call him to the stand or interview him and get that same information? You know, what's that dispute is, it doesn't, from Holt's point of view, it doesn't seem like Titus pointed the gun at, you know, this 16, 17 year old kid. And it's the exact opposite, saying, no, he, you know, I don't know if he would call it pleasant, but, you know, he was polite and he said, please, you know, just stay off our property. And they were like, okay. And they all left. Like, It was that simple.
They also talk for a while, too. Even Chris Whippy acknowledges they talked for like 5 to 10 minutes after this happened. I'm like, if he pointed a gun at y'all, it's not going to be like a chit chat for 5 to 10 minutes. It's going to be.
No.
And Andrew Holt describes him talking. I mean, like, being dead honest, if.
When we asked Andrew, like, well, what if Titus had, like, had gun pointed? And he's like, well, he basically said they would have pulled their guns on him or beat him down or something. Like, they would not have.
Titus would not have survived the encounter. Straight up.
This is, like, such a different world. Because if someone points a gun at me, like, I'm calling the cops as soon as I get the hell away from that person. Colin, I have a question for you because this is another theme we see, I think, again and again, talking about how people's stories changed after they saw, you know, Titus's mugshot on TV. Is that an example of confirmation bias as much as it is an example of, you know, easily being coerced by the cops to remember something that perhaps didn't happen?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that's been shown in studies and experiments done when you have eyewitnesses. And right, if you will show them something benign or neutral at first, they'll have one impression. And then if you add additional information, it wouldn't even be really confirmation bias would be more they think that Titus acted inappropriately or violently, and then that was confirmed when they found out he was charged with this murder of the hunters. Whereas this would
be
I'm not even sure what the psychological term would be, but it's changing them from initially thinking this encounter was benign and then finding out, oh, well, actually this person has been accused of murdering these two hunters, and that distorts your memory because now you're being told new information that can influence what you initially thought.
Yeah, I've seen this over and over again down there with people who weren't talked to by the police, weren't like witnesses or anything, but after the show came out, they learned about it and like reached out to me, and they're like, I gotta tell you, man, I had this weird encounter with Titus in the woods one time. I'm like, okay, let's hear it. And they're like, I was out there. I was on like his neighbor's land hunting with permission. And Titus came and checked me out and saw who I was, saw I had permission, and then left. And like, I just got a weird feeling from that. I'm like, that's your story? That's the reason you've been convinced for 30 years that he's guilty? Because he saw someone on land and that had a lot of trespassers and like came by, checked it out, and then said, hey, and left? Like,
right.
I get it. I'd be weirded out too. I'd feel seriously uncomfortable if something happened to me and the guy was convicted of murder. But like, these people tell these stories with like a they have a firm belief this is evidence thing was weird and wrong going on or strange. And maybe it's strange since Jeff Titus, but like it's like you hear the stories and you're like, I'm not hearing the murdery stuff coming through there.
Right. What I hear is, you know, this is another like phenomenon that I've seen again and again and again. When something bad happens, there's sort of this narrative like it could have been me that kind of bubbles up, and people think about all the ways they could have ended up in that situation. Oh, it could have been me if only I'd gotten there 5 minutes earlier, or if only I had, you know, X, Y, Z. That seems to be a way that sort of influences people's memory, too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, Jacinda, remind us who Dale Beatty is.
Dale Beatty.
Should I ask who's in this question?
Yeah, maybe you should. He came for it much later. It was like 2001 or two.
It was two. He was February. I think he's the last one I found. Well, he's the last one, I think, who shows up in the prosecutor's disclosures.
Okay. So talk about, Susan, what is the significance of Dale Beatty? What did he do?
I mean, it's hard to talk about because there's not much here. Like literally all we had to start with was that disclosure from the prosecutor and then his testimony. Which is hilarious. but there's that, like, that was it. Like, he has a story of like he's out in the woods and Jeff Titus. Well, there's several variations, so I don't even know what the canon one is. But basically, he's out there and Titus comes up to him and like threatens him to get off the state game area. And that's when you have the exchange where Dale Beatty flips off a safety and says, like, that shit goes both ways. And then Titus is so intimidated, he just leaves. He just departs. Like, It's part of me gets really annoyed at the jury. I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, if you're a juror and you heard this and you believed it, like, yeah, I got questions. I mean, it's hard to be a juror because all you can hear is what you're allowed to hear. And people who are answering questions for a little while on the stand just can seem credible. Like, if they can just, you know, keep a straight face, it's not hard to swear they're believable. But like, the story is so inherently nonsense that like, it is aggravating they believed it. Like, why? Why would you possibly hear the story and think that's true?
Right. How there's a combat gear assault rifle tail too, right?
There is. And that's like another part. So if there's like a core truth to this whole Beatty story, I do kind of believe this idea that at some point Dale Beatty was out there and saw a banana clip rifle because or banana clip on some kind of assault rifle, because it's the one consistent thing through all the stories. He always seems to mention it. His son mentioned it in both his letter and when I talked to him. And I'm extremely skeptical it had anything to do with Titus, but like, I think he probably did see someone with banana clip assault rifle and got freaked out by it. And the combat gear thing is also interesting to me because we've heard several times from other people, like Martinko's one of them. I remember talking to him Jacinda, and he's like, yeah, I heard that people in combat gear were always back there. And then someone else told us about like the Michigan militia was like practicing back there. And I kind of want like, and not like, a, and by that I mean, not the same Michigan militia, but kind of like the groups that we saw active in Michigan recently with the threats against Governor Whitmer. And
yeah,
I mean, I have no proof of it, but like from the talk that I've heard, it seems very plausible to me that there was a militia group that was practicing back there in the game area.
Hmm. We call them domestic terror groups now. We don't call them militias anymore.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about how Dale Beatty's story even came into play. It was his son, right, who wrote a letter, like that there was a family connection there and there was some motivation there, right? Can you just remind me about what that situation was?
We don't know the entire Beatty situation because there are like both of them said they talked to police before this. So I think there's a piece we don't have yet. But what I do know is that in December, a few days after Titus's arrest, he's in the jail there with Kenneth Beatty, who's Dale Beatty's son. And Kenneth Beatty writes to a guard, says, hey, my dad and I can testify that Titus was territorial if you can get me home for Christmas. And this was never disclosed to the defense. They did not call Kenneth to testify for obvious reasons, but they called Dale and did not disclose it. And now this is, I wish I had the records to show what happened to Kenneth Beatty. I don't know if any rewards were given. I don't know if any favors were done, but it kind of seems to me like the prosecutor was thinking, since it's not the traditional Brady situation of the witness themselves asking for a benefit, then it's not Brady and there's no disclosure that needs to be done, where I would strongly disagree.
What do you think, Colin? Is it a Brady violation to not disclose that this witness could have been motivated by making a deal to get out of jail early? Son's making a deal. Yeah, yeah.
It matters a lot, though, because if it was him, it'd be different.
Yeah, I think that gets to Susan's point about not exactly knowing the timeline or how this sort of unfolded. If it's just the son independently is reaching out and the father has no knowledge of this and the father just in good faith is working with the police, it wouldn't be Brady. On the other hand, if we think that the son led the police to the father, there's some more of a nexus there. There could be Brady. So I think we need more details to be able to say there's enough of a nexus to make this exculpatory evidence.
I'm curious about how we know about it then. Susan, how do we even know about this whole Kenneth Beatty situation?
Oh, because the letter was in the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's file.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had it was just tucked down there. I'm like, what is this? Unfold, it's a kite. I'm like, oh, that's what this Kenneth Beatty is about. But again, there's a missing piece here just before we can say it's Brady, but like, I find it extremely implausible that a father would be unaware of the fact that his son was, I mean, first of all, Dale Beatty was not a witness, not going to be a witness for this. He had been interviewed apparently, allegedly with a son. I'm not sure I can confirm that or not. I can't confirm it. I don't know if he was, but he also definitely was not going to be a witness. He was not going to be on the stand. They had no intention of calling him before Kenneth wrote this letter. So there is a connection between Kenneth writing the letter and ultimately the prosecutor deciding to call Dale. And again, I guess theoretically in a, you know, in a hypothetical world, it's possible this could have happened without Dale knowing that Kenneth had made the request. I find it unlikely as a practical matter. And I think that the defense should have had a chance to poke around and find out what was going on. On the other hand, they would have done jack shit, as far as I can tell. So not like it would have mattered. But
right. What do you think, Jacinda, about this potential connection here? Do you agree with Susan?
I do agree with Susan. I think it's too much of a coincidence that, you know, the father didn't know his son was trying to get out early to come home, or that, you know, he must wonder why now out of the blue are people contacting me? Like, how did you even find me? That'd be the first question I asked if someone knocked on my door, you know. But my favorite part about his story is that, you know, Titus backs away, which in my mind contradicts everything else you've heard about him, you know, confronting people and they're backing away from him. But now, you know, he backs away. And if you believe what you've heard about Titus, I don't know how, you know, why would you believe that? Wouldn't that have made him really, really mad? He would have circled back to something like the story seems like, I don't know. It seems exaggerated.
Bullshit.
Yeah. That's a good word.
This is the other thing that's like so interesting about this case is there are so many like father son things going on in this story, right? Like me and dad. I mean, maybe it's just because it's a hunting related story and hunting is an activity that a lot of fathers and sons do together in this area. But like the whole story about the guy whose dad was also full of shit all the time. he told you that. Like there just seems to be a lot of that going on.
Yeah, the Richard Adams thing, that, I, you know, probably never answers because he's dead there, but it, I wish I'd started this case like 20 years ago. It would have been a lot more fun then, a lot easier to find out, which is also kind of why it's so frustrating, because Titus's case, like, there are so many holes in it that are fairly low-hanging fruit, so to speak, that no one even bothered to check in the beginning. And I will say, from what Jacinda was saying earlier, like, the prosecutor's theory here, like, in their closing argument, Scott Brower, and it's a very poetic, compelling piece of writing in terms of, like, you know, just the writing itself. But he says, we know that Titus is all violent and aggressive because he confronted these four people in the woods before. But the only reason things went different is because these four, they had the sense to quietly turn and walk away. And if they had not, if they had talked back like Doug Estes probably would have talked back, they'd have been dead too. And then they like he goes from that to immediately talking about the Beatty story. I'm like, how can you possibly like connect these two dots here? Like you just told us that the only reason these four lived because they turned and walked away. And now you're saying that Dale Beatty is said like that shit goes both ways and threatened him back. And then he so like, wait, why did OK, so let's say Titus did all of this. How is this proof he's the killer? Because obviously if Doug Estes, who's like 6'5" or something, had started talking back. Based on the Beatty story, Titus is just going to skedaddle. He's not going to do double homicide.
Right, right.
Every time you say that shit goes both ways, I think Clint Eastwood.
See, I also suspect that's the part that like will connect the Beattys together because I'm going to guess you're going to find a statement from, I bet Dale Beatty did report the possible militia guys, the assault rifle guys that he saw. And if his statement has nothing about this, that shit goes both ways, I bet it comes from his son's letter. Like that to me feels like his son's invention.
So what, I'm curious, what records are you missing that you think exist that you would love to have right now?
DNR.
Yeah.
DNR.
Do you just talk about that?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, there's not much to talk about, unfortunately, because guess what? There are none. So the DNR was allegedly had a number of incidents reported to them involving Titus.
Remind listeners what DNR is.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
First.
I've been in Michigan too long.
It's okay. Oh, it's all right.
Department of Natural Resources? Yeah, that's it. It's the body that handles all the game-related complaints. Like if there's something goes on.
Like fish and game.
Yeah, like poaching or, you know, in the game area stuff. And we know that a number of reports were made about stuff going on in this area. I filed a FOIA request. They told me there are no such documents and cannot elaborate whether none ever existed or they've now destroyed them pursuant to retention schedules. They're just like, nope, nothing. There's no sign of any of this ever happening. We have no records in any way related to any kind of conflict between people in the game area from the whole time Titus lived there. So there's nothing. Also, good time for a shout out. If your name sounds something like Julie Grabowski and you work for the DNR in Michigan, please call me.
That's very specific.
It is, because there's a DNR agent official, I don't know her title, who must know a ton of relevant information about this. She was the one who processed the complaints, talked to Titus, talked to people. And Titus says her name is Julie Grabowski, but I cannot find any DNR employee named Julie Grabowski, so I think he's got the name wrong and I cannot find her. So shout out to all Julie Grabowski-ish sounding people. If you work for the DNR, please call.
So there were reports made. I mean, that no one is disputing that there were reports made, but the DNR is just saying they don't exist at this time. That's
well,
right.
I'm disputing that not all of them were made. I don't know if they're real or not. Here's a should talk about earlier for Andrew Holt. He was the one with the Whitbys who would have testified that There was no gun pulled at anyone. He says he made a DNR complaint, and Titus Rome is being asked about it, so that seems like there was a DNR complaint made. And it could also go back to why Andrew Holt was not called as a witness, because Andrew Holt, when he talked to the police, said, no, no gun was pulled. Also, a different year, I was in the game area, and I saw something that he thought could have been Titus, but he was like 400 yards away, so he can't say who it was. But he saw someone standing on a roof who was shooting a .22 caliber rifle like into the trees above him from very, very far away. It was originally in the episode. I cut it out because end of the day, the story was like, well, no one could stand Titus's barn roof because you'd just fall off and die. So that definitely didn't happen. But I wish I had the DNR reports to see what he was actually describing. And I feel like that would help us narrow down what he was talking about.
Well, are there any other encounters or alleged encounters between Titus and hunters that the prosecution didn't use at trial? Is there other stuff out there?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of them. I mean, Jacinda, how many witnesses did we talk to who had like a new encountered Titus / someone in the woods story?
It seems like everyone we talked to, but it never seemed like it was actually Titus they were talking about.
Yeah, I've talked to two people who like I feel very confident are talking about Titus, and they're just nothing stories. It's like he came up and said hi. And there's a whole ton of stories of things that are, I mean, go from totally nothing to like pretty serious, and we have no idea who it is.
Colin, I have a procedural question for you about, you know, FOIA and agencies like the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, which, you know, in New Hampshire, it's fish and game, and they actually are, you know, they're law enforcement officers, and they're sort of a branch of, I mean, if you've ever seen Northwoods Law, it's about New Hampshire fish and game. But in terms of, like, FOIA and documentation, you know, what is the difference between a governmental entity like the DNR here in this state or other states and law enforcement or attorney general's office or a different kind of state agency when it comes to, you know, obtaining records? Are they, you know, they're not typically necessarily involved in murder trials. So, like, what's the difference there when it comes to requesting stuff like this?
I mean, the answer is, unless there's something strange under Michigan's FOIA law, they should be equally susceptible to a FOIA request. And in fact, they would probably have less of a reason to claim the information is privileged and non-disclosable because, you know, to your point, they're not usually involved in murder investigations. And so, yeah, I mean, they should be fully required to disclose if there's a valid FOIA request.
Well, I'll say that both Ohio DNR and Michigan DNR both had the same response to everything I've tried to get from them, which is like, oh, we have nothing, and we have no explanation for why we have nothing. We can't tell you anything. Literally, I asked one of them, I'm like, okay, what do you want me to say about, like, why you have nothing? And the guy's response, and it's like a DNR attorney, was like, you can tell them they're just, no responsive documents exist. I'm like, can I say why? They're like, nope, that's all you can say. I'm like, that's a nonsense response. Y'all got some issues going on. Anyway, point being, Colin, actually, for Brady purposes, does it matter if the agency has like a law enforcement role? Like, say this was not, DNR does have law enforcement capacity role, so they're not totally non-law enforcement. But if it was like, shoot, what's an agency that has no law enforcement whatsoever?
Like the DMV?
Yes.
Or no, they actually do because they can pull license. How about like
food inspection?
Yeah,
say a food inspection agency has records that are exculpatory. Would Brady at all touch that?
It's an interesting question. I mean, the key case is a case out of New Orleans, Kyles versus Whitley, which says it includes law enforcement and police, not just prosecutors. I'm not sure that I've ever seen a court opinion dealing with Brady that talks about like food inspection or, you know, national forest or something.
Just
so
something not at all like, law enforcement-y.
Yeah, I don't know how a court would deal with that. I assume they would find that Brady does not apply, that it only is agencies involved in law enforcement. But that's just a guess. I haven't actually seen an opinion dealing with that.
So what's frustrating here is that I know for a fact DNR responded to this murder scene because I have heard, I don't know for a fact. I know very strongly that there are reports and people who are related people in the DNR who said they responded that night as part of the murder investigation. So they were part of the law enforcement response and they should have records that are related to the criminal investigation. And they just apparently ceased to exist somewhere along the way and no one can say why.
Yeah, I mean, how do they find people if they don't know if people are repeat offenders or whatever, for whatever their rules are, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the lottery commissions keep records of who comes in and claims $5 from their scratch tickets, you know, when people come to the office and their prize is over a certain amount. You would think that...
You know what I should do? I should ask how, like, can I, records of people, like, poaching in the woods from that time period. Like,
yes,
they have
you should.
I'm going to do
should
that.
Ask for something less directive
less
and you
murdery.
Should just be more general.
But
yes,
we talked
yes.
to someone, Susan, remember the one guy we talked to, which I thought was fascinating, who was saying that the DNR, they don't need a search warrant. They can just come in and tell you to open up their barn doors and garage doors, and they can like search your property.
I had questions about that. We were told this about someone who's like, yeah, DNR can come search wherever they want, and it's not law enforcement, so it's fine. And I'm like, I don't think they're doing that. If they are, then we should talk to the ACLU and like get someone going on here. But there was a belief by people in that area that the DNR can just come in and check out whatever they want to do without a warrant.
Well, wildlife protection is a little different than other kinds of law enforcement because there's, I mean, my understanding is from watching Northwoods Law that there's no, there's no like natural advocate for say a poached animal or an illegally kept animal. Like there's no, you know, there's no Department of Human Services with a Child Protective Division like for deer, for instance. So they play that role. They're both like the conservation police and they're the police like on behalf of wildlife. Life and animals, and that's and they enforce those rules. So that's my understanding.
And therefore,
and
the Fourth Amendment
the
doesn't
case.
Apply. I'm not sure if there's like a deer exception.
Listen,
to that.
I'm just saying that's my understanding of why they seem to be very comfortable knocking on windows when they come and meet people. And
deer
up
rights
up against people in the woods.
well, the one guy anyway. We had talked to, he's like actually like he pointed to his barn. He's like, I just leave the door of the barn open because I'm tired of them coming looking for meth labs in there.
Huh? Well, they shouldn't be looking for meth labs. That's not their job.
I don't. Yeah.
So a question that you raise in the episode is, you know, whether or not there could have been somebody else confronting people in the woods who was not Titus, because you do have some people who say I was confronted by someone who later changed their story and said it was Titus. So do you think that there was a bad actor out there being a dick to people in the woods, like in a serial way?
I think that's true regardless of the murders. I feel like that's something that just happens in the Fulton Game area. I've heard a lot of the stories that are kind of disturbing about someone out there with this kind of similar pattern, and it's definitely not Titus. Like, I think the part of the problem is you have a lot of people and a lot of incidents, so trying to separate them is hard. For instance, yeah. We have Alan Stanton to the south, and we have Mark Davis, who was to the north of Titus. I suspect they're probably both responsible for some encounters people had of people who felt uncomfortable out there. But I think that's just like how life is. I don't think that makes it connected to the murder. But I do think those stories are getting imputed to Titus when it's just regular old other stuff going on.
Yeah,
I've gone back and forth on this. I don't know. Like I think something else could have been going on because I've heard people that have no reason to be lying and just aren't really telling a. It's not like a dramatic tale, and it's just like, hey, yeah, I was out there and this happened, and it was weird, and it is kind of weird, and it seems like for 20 years that was kind of happening, and I don't have any answers there.
Jacinda, have you heard the same thing?
Definitely, yeah. I think there were other people out there chasing people off their property or walking through the woods and scaring people. Like, I think, like Susan was saying, other people doing it doesn't mean they're the murderer or they're guilty of anything. But these are not just all stories about Titus.
The stories that concern me, though, the ones I really feel like I are worth trying to find an answer for. There's an area of the game area that it's just not near anyone's property lines. Like there's no one who could conceivably have gotten confused over this. Like it just isn't private property. It's clearly state game area. It's clearly public. There's no reason for any kind of dispute. And there's an area of the east side of Bear Creek where people keep having encounters, like with people saying, you need to get out of here right now. But I don't think it's about private property. So, like, what's it about then?
So that might be where the domestic terror / militia kind of running around.
If they're hiding in the swamp, that's totally what's going on.
Huh.
It could be where they're growing their wheat, too, because like, we have heard stories of that.
Hello, Ozark. Yes.
We've heard lots of stories, but no one's actually smoking
wheat
in the area. So until I find someone who says, yes, I have my plant there, I'm on the fence on that one. But it's possible.
Colin, I have a question for you. I don't want to ask you to speculate too much, but From my own experience, and I can imagine this might be the case with some of these witnesses, if you run into somebody in the woods with a gun and have an incident with them, I've never had a negative incident, but I have run into plenty of people in the woods with a gun. I don't remember what any of them look like. I only remember the gun. Like, that seems to be like the memory you walk away with, a guy with a gun, not a face, not a voice, not a hairstyle. Like, that seems reasonable, right? That, like, that face is kind of blank because you're thinking about the incident and the gun. I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened here, but I think it could have been.
Yeah, and that's something I think two of the eyewitness experts I had on for the Jonathan Irons series talk about, how when there's a gun involved, and especially if the gun is pointed at you, you have what's called gun focus or weapon focus, and that decreases your ability to identify the face because your attention naturally is drawn to the firearm as opposed to the facial features of the person.
Jacinda, yeah. Could you ID the guy with the camo paint and the turkey tent?
You know, I was just thinking about that. So we walked in, we walked back into the woods one day, and the season hadn't opened yet, but this guy was there, we thought, in a tent. And when we walked in, he kind of opened a little flap.
It pops out, like, all cheerful. It's like, hello there.
And I don't know that I could describe him. I think he had a hat on that was, but yeah.
I could definitely not ID him, but I couldn't have done the next day either. But yeah, he was very cheerful, which is almost alarming too. Someone pop out of what you think is like the woodland floor, like pop out with face paint, be like, what's going on? And how did you do?
I remember the tent.
And
that, because it was a little freaky, but
right.
But also the descriptions of people, you know, confronting people in the woods, it's all over the place, from like glasses, no glasses, beard, mustache, you know,
they're all white.
Older, younger, they're all white. But
that I believe.
There's not like a consistent description.
Well, actually, you say that, but there is a whole issue in this case. On the day of the murders, there was a group of hunters that's never been identified and were acting possibly suspiciously. But no one knows what, because like half the people are like, yeah, I saw some Mexicans. I'm like, half, like, I saw some Asians. I'm like, okay, well.
Yeah, some were very, yeah, it was like Mexicans or some Vietnamese.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like they're Vietnamese hunters and like the Mexican hunters. Like, is it? Are y'all talking about the same people? I think they are, but no one seems to know who these hunters were, like what even remote ethnicity they were.
All right. Well, Susan, I know we're taking a couple weeks off from the show, but what is coming up in the next upcoming episodes of Undisclosed after the holidays?
So from here on out, we're talking about the evidence that was used to get Titus into prison, the bulk of the case, which is just like people saying stuff Titus said or did at one point or another. Nothing to do with the murders, because like all the evidence, it's pretty limited. We've gone over it all. So now we get to hear about some of the coworkers and neighbors that Titus had and their many years later reports of conversations with him.
Colin, like me, are you like, can't wait, like really anticipating the episode, the inevitable episode about the incompetence of this defense team?
I feel like that's
the
kinda,
Gutierrez episode.
Rebecca, you're gonna love
heard
it.
Some, so yeah, this defense team in this case certainly is not a shining example that attorneys would want to follow who are entering the defense bar.
Can't wait. All right, well, Colin Miller, thanks so much for joining us for the addendum this week. It was really fun talking with you.
Yeah, good catching up with you.
And Jacinda, always a pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
And Susan Simpson, man, if you can send me some notes on this defense team thing in advance, I'd really appreciate a couple spoilers, okay? All right, guys, thanks so much for talking with me about Undisclosed this week. Thanks so much for listening. We will be back after the holiday break with more Undisclosed and the Undisclosed Addendum. Do you have a question for the next addendum? Tips about any of the cases covered on the podcast, including the Titus case? You can email your questions and tips to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them our way on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Audio production of the addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Meethal Telhan. Follow the show on social media everywhere at Undisclosed Pod. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On. And for everyone at Undisclosed, happy holidays. See you in a couple weeks.